WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Louisiana Considered. I'm Bob Pavlovich. On today's show, hunger has reached startling levels in Louisiana, and the Landry administration has refused $71 million in federal funds to feed qualified school children over the summer. Will that strain an already taut safety net? And 17-year-olds can now face adult-level punishment for crimes under a new state law. One parent and criminal justice researcher says that won't reduce crime in the long run. But first, it's Thursday, and that means it's time to catch up on politics with the Times-Picayune, The Advocate's editorial director and columnist, Stephanie Grace. Steph, thanks for being here again.
Thanks for having me.
So the legislature's back in Baton Rouge, the third time since Governor Landry's taken office. Is this regular session shaping up to be just another special session, a continuation, rather, of what we saw during those two special sessions?
Well, I'd say yes and no in different ways. What's similar is that Landry is still a new governor, which means he's still trying to use the momentum from his election to make really big changes. Mm-hmm. In other words, we're still essentially in the honeymoon period.
Yeah.
What's also similar is that Landry's got a legislature that's likely to be very much on the same page as he is, with not only a Republican supermajority, but a real conservative tilt within that supermajority, within the kind of range of Republican thought. Mm-hmm. So an awful lot of lawmakers want to do the same things he wants to do, even if the general public doesn't necessarily agree. And those people have been assigned to lead committees. So, you know, this is something we saw with a crime special session. The criminal justice committees were really stacked with allies. Mm-hmm. All that said, a regular session is different from a special session in a couple ways. First, it's longer. It's nearly 3 months in this case. So things don't generally move as quickly. And that means there is more time for public debate and for opponents to get organized and make their case. Landry and his allies still could ram some things through quickly, but not everything. The second difference is that in a special session, the issue areas under consideration are really chosen by the governor. The governor says you can legislate on these things. Mm-hmm. In a regular session, any lawmaker can file any bill on almost anything. Uh-huh. So, you know, you get just a wider range of proposals and some things that don't come directly through the governor's office that could get some legs. The exception there, I'd say, is fiscal matters. Some of them can't be considered this year, things like new taxes, because that happens next year.
So what are they going to grapple with first?
Oh, I think insurance is going to be the first thing to come up. It's a huge issue. Everybody knows the property insurance crisis we're in. New insurance commissioner Tim Temple really wants to move legislation quickly, in part because hurricane season is coming up, and he wants the legislation to send a message to the industry and the reinsurance market that things are changing. Landry has signaled that he pretty much agrees with Temple's overall approach. And, you know, what that approach is really kind of a pure free market approach. Temple comes out of the industry. He favors removing regulations in the hope that more companies will want to do business here. And that theoretically would lead to more competition. And mm-hmm. That theoretically would lead to lower rates at some point. So we don't know when. The flip side is that those regulations are there to protect consumers. And, you know, this is an industry where there's been a lot of consumer dissatisfaction after various storms, as we all know. Mm-hmm. One really popular regulation Temple is aiming at is known as the 3-year rule. And that bars property insurers from dropping residential customers if they've been with a company for 3 years, except under some very specific circumstances. It's unique to Louisiana. Temple said that's a red flag in and of itself. If it were a good idea, everyone would do it. But a lot of people here love it. And that includes former Republican Commissioner Jim Donilon, who credits it with saving people's coverage after Katrina. But the insurance companies really don't like it, so they're going to be happy with this. Lawmakers are also looking to give insurers the ability to raise rates more easily and to pretty significantly change how lawsuits against insurers are handled. So keep an eye on all of that.
And I see they're going to take another crack at expanding closed primaries to cover more offices, including legislators.
Yes, a bill's been filed. And while Landry and the state Republican Party still really want that to happen, I don't think the sentiment among lawmakers has changed since the Senate really watered down a proposal in the first special session. You know, this really affects how people vote, and it's very personal to the people who get elected under a system that to them works because they got elected that way, and also to voters. It would disenfranchise a bunch of voters who aren't registered in political parties. On the other hand, the governor does have a lot of favors he can trade if he's intent on pushing it. So I guess he can't say never say never.
Stephanie Grace, the Times-Picayune, the Advocate's editorial director and columnist. Thanks again for being here.
Okay, thank you.
Seventeen-year-olds can now be tried as adults in many criminal cases in Louisiana. The change came out of lawmakers' recent special session on crime. Governor Jeff Landry says the new rules will help make communities safer. But many researchers say similar so-called juvenile justice policies have actually led to more crime in the long term. One of those researchers is Anita Raj, executive director of the Newcomb Institute of Tulane University and the Nancy Reeves Drew Endowed Chair. She's also a parent and wrote about child incarceration recently for the Louisiana Illuminator. Anita, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
What was the motivation for you to write the opinion piece for the Illuminator?
Well, I am originally from Mississippi and had gone to school at Tulane. I've only recently moved back, and when I moved back about in August, I was really struck by the story of the youth that were at Angola. And so when I started seeing the news reports come out and also just some of the legislative documents come out about how young people could be to be placed into adult facilities as, you know, incarcerated in adult facilities, I just could not respond. It is very painful to see, especially after seeing what had happened to the youth in Angola this past summer, that this is on the table. But also as a researcher, I just was deeply concerned that this approach is so antithetical to what we know is best for children, even children who are engaging in behaviors that are absolutely unacceptable.
How do Louisiana's teen incarceration numbers rank compared to other states?
Yeah, so as I had written in my op-ed, very specifically with regard to youth incarceration in adult facilities, it's about 0.03% of our state, those that are incarcerated in our state facilities. That is quite a bit lower for Mississippi, which is about 0.1%. And I am from Mississippi, but I've chosen to live in Louisiana. So I'd like to believe that we will do better than Mississippi, which is often among the lower ranked states. And it's quite a bit higher, three times higher than what you see in Texas. And so, you know, Texas is a state that has a very strong economy and has, you know, some strong, very, very strong schools in the state to help support their youth advance. And it has some really nice youth development programs. And I think that can be more of a model for us than I think youth incarceration in adult facilities.
What charges are most likely to result in teens being tried as adults?
It's going to be violent crimes, you know, felonies. It can be armed hijackings. It doesn't necessarily have to be that the act of violence was completed, so to speak, in terms of someone actually being harmed. You know, I think we can all agree that we don't want guns in the hand of minor-aged youth. And understanding how those youth are getting those guns is, I think, really a good use of our time and a way to help address this concern. But one is if these youth are able to get guns, then they are more able to get to commit an act of violence with a gun. And worse, a youth or anyone in a moment of crisis, extreme crisis, can engage in something with that gun that can end with a death. And that is something we want to avert. I'm not convinced, there are no data convince me that incarceration of these youth is the solution. I think getting the guns out of the hands of these youth and again, youth development, getting ensure we're getting our kids back into their schools. I think those are the solutions we need to be focusing on.
How are teens affected by incarceration alongside adults in the short term?
What we do with our youth by putting them into these adult facilities do have a direct impact on immediate health, social needs, not just for them, but for, you know, what those costs are to our state. But I was reading an article today in preparation for this discussion, and it increases the likelihood that we're going to see, our working age population actually die. It increases the risk for early mortality. So something to really consider and forestall.
This is Louisiana Considered, and we're speaking with Anita Raj, Executive Director of the Newcomb Institute at Tulane University, about her recent opinion piece on teenage incarceration in Louisiana. How do high incarceration rates affect the state's economy? You mentioned that specifically in your op-ed.
So, incarceration doesn't come without cost. So there is the immediate cost of incarceration, and while there are public-private partnerships that can be involved, I think certainly we certainly don't want to have a profitability for incarcerating people. That's an incentivization for incarceration. I don't think anybody would prefer that. But then there's sort of there are the long-term effects. It because of the mental health effects, because actually part of the issue, as I was also reading up on this, is that there aren't the healthcare needs met in these facilities, the pediatric care that might be needed, adolescent care that might be needed. And they're not going to get the counseling because it is very atypical for somebody to commit a violent crime at such a fragile age without some kind of trauma having occurred in their lives. So that trauma is not being addressed in our current adult facilities. And so the cost to that of that for society is quite multifold. You're not just talking about the cost of the immediate incarceration, but for recidivism, healthcare, loss of our working population in young adulthood and into adulthood, loss of a skilled population of workers, those costs are just enormous.
You end your editorial by saying, "We need to prioritize supporting our children rather than incarcerating them if we truly want to create a better present and future for our state." What kind of support do you have in mind?
Let me say there are three things I think that are incredibly important. One is education. We have to make sure that the youth in our state get a level of education commensurate with their preparation to be contributing members of society. We want to help get those dropout rates improved. That's going to reduce our crime rates with youth. We've been seeing that. We've seen that across studies multiple years. So getting kids into school, if you're going to incarcerate kids, juvenile justice or whatever, we need to make sure that they have strong education to support them. Vocational training is also a piece of this. Not everybody is going to go or wants to go into higher education. We need a skilled working population in our society. There are many jobs out there that we need filled, and supporting vocational training as well as education can help boost our economy for the state. I think incredibly importantly, the issues of trauma and mental health support. When we see youth engaging in behaviors like this, it doesn't come from nowhere. The idea of this being innately what happens is not something that science supports. This is really an issue that often is because this is youth that are coming from situations or circumstances where needs were not met, where survival may be in place, where there were not the kinds of role models and social supports that we'd ideally like to see for our youth. And so I think that it's really important to have counseling, support, trauma-informed care, and stabilization of their lives so that they can become working members of our society, educated and working members of our society.
For an improved youth criminal justice system, are there systems in use in other states or countries that you see as a good replacement for the current one?
I have to tell you, I work in a lot of countries around the world, and they are staggered when they hear that we put our youth into the same facilities that we put our adults. So we're talking about, countries that have lesser crime, lesser violent crime than we do, and have lesser resources to support their population, and actually, frankly, lower levels of education in their society. And we don't see the level of violent crime, and it is just simply not by policy that they put youth in with adult incarcerated people. So this is actually something that on a global stage is quite shocking. This is not an evidence data-driven solution, and it's harming our state and harming our economy.
Anita Raj, Executive Director of the Newcomb Institute of Tulane University. Thanks again for being here and speaking with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Hunger in Louisiana has reached startling levels. Close to a fifth of residents receive some type of public assistance to buy groceries or eat meals at school. Last month, Governor Jeff Landry's administration turned down a major form of federal assistance, $71 million to be exact. It was part of a summer electronic benefit transfer, and it's mainly used to help feed children during the summer months when they aren't getting school breakfast or lunch. We're joined by Second Harvest President and CEO Natalie Jayrow to explain the action's effects and what's available to take its place. Thank you for being here, Natalie.
Thank you so much for having me, Robert.
The governor insists that there are what he calls robust safety nets, programs already in place that every child will be able to receive the meals that they need throughout the summer. In your opinion, is that true?
Respectfully, I disagree. You know, we are the largest anti-hunger organization, we as in Second Harvest, in the state of Louisiana. We're currently distributing 40 million meals across 23 South Louisiana parishes. But we know that we need to be twice the size that we are now just to fill the gap after a family takes care of themselves and takes advantage of all the federal programs available. So right now, the average SNAP benefit is $6 per day per person. So could you eat on $6 a day?
No.
And we do everything we can, and we'll continue to do everything we can. One of the beauties of the work I get to do is that we're partners to government, and yet we see this incredible outpouring of private support. This summer, for instance, in addition to the normal food distribution we'll do through parishes, we will double our summer feeding programs. We run three kitchens, one here in Harahan, one in Vermilion, one out in Lake Charles on the McNeese campus in partnership with them. And by doubling that, we can reach about 5,000 children this summer, over 70 different locations. But just in our 23 South Louisiana parishes, 117,000 children are food insecure. Mm-hmm. So we can help through our pantries, getting more groceries into the hands of our families, through our meals that are coming out of our kitchens, but we cannot replace $71 million worth of benefits.
That $71 million of the summer EBT, is that a loss or is that just a missed opportunity?
Well, I think it's a loss because I believe that Louisianans pay federal tax dollars. Mm-hmm. And this is an instance where the federal government said, we're going to give you $71 million of your tax dollars back. And it's going to go out in $40 increments per child with children that are eligible on an EBT card. So that money, we don't save anything in Louisiana. There's no benefit to it. That money goes somewhere else. So that's just taxpayer dollars that don't come into the state of Louisiana. We understand the challenges of budgets, et cetera, and the tough decisions our politicians need to make. But this one was hard for me to understand because it was just a loss for us, a lost opportunity. But $71 million, we're not going to get back as a state that could help our kids. You know, I feel like there was no downside. In addition to that, these are dollars because they go onto EBT cards that families can spend in grocery stores. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that our grocery stores are struggling with the same inflationary challenges that our citizens are facing when they go into grocery stores. So we see a lot of grocery stores in our rural service areas closing. We have a grocery store on wheels program called Mobile Market, and we're being asked to go into more and more communities with that moving grocery store because these rural areas don't have grocery stores anymore selling fresh produce. And I always look at something like the $71 million as a benefit to kids, but also what an economic benefit to those grocery stores because it's getting spent in the local economy.
We're speaking with Natalie Jayrow, President and CEO of Second Harvest. Are schools able to help fill the void as well?
They can if they want to participate in providing summer meals, but that is a lot of work. It's not something you can turn on a dime with, right? You have to have staff, you have to have facilities, you have to buy the food. The way that the summer feeding program works, because there is some federal reimbursement that comes along with it, you go through a process where everything has to be approved months in advance before you can buy the food for those programs. So it's really late now for anybody to kind of switch gears and say, well, I'm going to run a summer program because we're not going to take summer EBT. It'd be very, very difficult. And we're also seeing some potential challenges, even with the summer feeding program, where we're being potentially asked to qualify every single child separately or in addition to the qualification they're already getting through the school system. That would mean that for the 5,000 kids we serve, we would have to have 5,000 applications completed by their parents with income verification in order to be reimbursed for those meals. That's not something we had to do in the past. We're trying to figure out if this is a federal rule that we can interpret differently or if we can get help, but that could be another thing that prevents us from reaching kids.
Is there a time during the summer that Second Harvest sees the greatest need?
Oh, yes. We triple the amount of meals that we're providing. We do after school meals too. So we may have 25, 30 locations that we're working with during the school year. We're going to have 70 locations during the summer in July and August. And, it could go on longer because a lot of camps and things shut down towards the end of July because schools get ready to start up again and they need a couple of weeks to get prepared. There's always that period of time in the beginning of August where kids are just going without.
Is the hole in the safety net those who have jobs making too much money to qualify for any assistance, but not enough to afford what they need to survive?
That's a great question. And the answer is nuanced. So, approximately 30% of the food insecure people that Second Harvest serves makes too much money to qualify for any be federal benefits. So, they would not be qualified for the summer EBT anyway, right? And that's exactly who you're talking about. In many cases, it's seniors whose fixed income is just a little bit too high and who do not get enough deductions to qualify them to receive SNAP. But most people who get SNAP are either children, disabled, or they've worked within the last year. So it may be that you have a gap between the skill set needed and the jobs that are available. Housing is so expensive now, it's way, way too expensive. How they take into account housing costs, what percentage of that budget it should be when they set up poverty statistics, that hasn't been looked at for decades. And housing can now take 50% of your income. That's how people get sideways because, when they set up those poverty numbers, it was 25 to 30% of your income. Then, with the incredible inflation over the last several years, where food may be 20% higher, you see all of your discretionary income go away, and families are struggling more and more. We had hoped that post-COVID, as the economy recovered, we would have seen a reduction in the need. And unfortunately, inflation picked up where COVID left off, and families have not been able to recover.
What should someone with kids who aren't sure just exactly how they're going to feed those kids this summer, what should they do?
They can certainly call in the greater New Orleans area 211. They can call 232 if they're out in Southwest Louisiana. They can go on to our website at no-hunger.org and take a look because we have a listing of where all of our pantries are. So, Second Harvest works through partners. We want to work through community-based organizations. So, what we try to do is connect people to the place closest to them where food is being distributed. So, definitely reach out and let us do the best we can for you.
Second Harvest President and CEO Natalie Jayro, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for covering this really important topic.
And that's today's Louisiana Considered. A thank you to our guests, Stephanie Grace, the Times-Picayune, the Advocate's editorial director and columnist, Anita Raj, executive director of the Newcomb Institute of Tulane University and the Nancy Reeves Drew Endowed Chair, and Natalie Jayro, president and CEO of Second Harvest. I would also like to thank Elena Mushka of the Acadiana Advocate and writer Aubrey Procell. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber. Our contributing producers are Matt Bloom and Adam Voss. We receive production and technical support from Garrett Pittman and our associate producer, Aubrey Procell. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7 p.m. on this station. It's also available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Bob Pavlovich. Thank you for listening.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience. More at rouses.com, with additional support from Southern Strategy Group.